Silence, brought to you by the fact that we don't have a sponsor here at the 10 o'clock hour.
Oh, no. Let's make one up.
All right. Meat Feet, the world's first roll-on deodorant for your feet.
Wow, that's pretty good.
Thousands of people think about the problem every day, but today you can solve it by putting on Neat Feet for $49.95, created by Dr. Sadie Taylor from New Zealand, who created Neat Feet for the New Zealand Army.
Was that one of your failed infomercials?
That got rated in 2005, worst infomercial of the year. Sold 17. $49.95 for roll-on for your feet.
But it was called Neat Feet? Is it
Neat? Neat Feet.
Neat Feet. So it got rid of the hair, too.
You know, it just took care of the stink. And we went to Nordstrom at 2 o'clock in the morning and filmed me smelling people's shoes.
Wow.
It was a low point.
Just like you normally do at 2 in the morning.
Is this different than the one where you pour the water in the shoe?
That was it.
Okay, that was the one.
That was the second part of it. Did you know that the average human being sweats more than a cup of perspiration into a single shoe in a single day?
And you pour the cup of water.
But we were struggling to figure out, should we pour the water into the shoe?
Yeah.
Or should we have the shoe be full of the water already and then pour? Because that's more like it. But every time we'd pour the shoe water into the container, you could see like
little bits
of stuff coming out of the shoe.
Oh my God.
There's a great second part to that story. There's a great second part. I don't have time to tell it some other time. Seattle Times is empowering reporters to drive subscription growth. They've done a pretty good job. They really turned things around when they realized we need to get our number of people that are subscribing to the Seattle Times to go up, because that's where they're going to make their money. It can't just be onesie twosie people in and out. You got to line up. I think they give you like 5 or 6 freebies and they make you pay, right?
Yeah.
Or something like that, even more than that. So now what they're doing is they're revealing to the writers for the Times, hey, these are the stories that people seem to like.
Yeah.
So why don't you give them more of the stories they seem to like, and then therefore we'll have subscriptions go up.
This is a real, I mean, they did a big, this is on the big Sunday spread yesterday in the paper. And the headline is how the Seattle Times is empowering reporters to drive subscriber growth. And the way it's really written in a kind of a dense gobbledygook, I felt. I'm a loyal Seattle Times subscriber. I don't need to subscribe, but I continue to subscribe, as does my mother. She also subscribes out of a sense of loyalty. I want to support the newspaper industry. So I am all on Seattle Times' side, and I understand how impossible it is to actually have profits when it comes to newspapers. So I don't want to act as if I am unaware of why they're doing this. But I was struck by the word empowering. So I think the basic... And this happens, you know, on MyNorthwest.com a lot, too. In fact, John, every month that Steph from MyNorthwest.com prints all the most popular, blog posts.
I delete it right away. Yes, I didn't even open it anymore because we're never on there.
They stopped carrying Tom and Curly.
Did they really?
Well, it feels like that. Maybe it's so far down I didn't have enough pages on my computer. Yeah. But anyway, and then just, how many hits and all that. And so they're kind of suggesting that there's something called clickbait, which is they give you a headline that makes you want to click. And if you click, then that's a sign to the people that posted it. Oh, well, good. See, there's interest. And then that's how we can kind of financially justify or remunerate people. And now Seattle Times says, we realize that's just kind of cheap. What really we need to do is we need to put our writers in touch with what drives not clicks, but what drives subscriptions?
Uh-huh.
What are the things that people are actually willing to pay for when they write these kinds of stories?
Right.
And the idea is that once reporters know that, they'll be doing a better job of doing it. The problem with me is, as a reporter, to say empowering makes me feel like I'm more slave to the reader.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they mentioned that one of the things they did, they're working on this long study about orcas, and they realized, wow, there's a lot of interest, so we can set a lot of short stories on that too about the orcas, and that's good. I mean, I think that's all to the good.
Right, but let's get back to the argument of, does the writer then begin to write for the reader as opposed to it just saying, we're going to give you your vegetables, you're going to get your proteins, you're going to get your starches, you're going to get it all right here.
That's a
balance, and you're going to, the best thing to do is eat your steak and then have your dessert.
Yes.
All they're doing is giving you the cheesecake, and people start to say, well, aren't we just giving the people what they want, because this is a commercial product, which is the news.
Exactly. And that's the danger. Right. Now, one can argue that this isn't just like, oh, people love puppies, more puppy stories, more animal stories, more this or that. They're not that kind of a crass in their approach. I mean, the idea is this is a long, in-depth study about orcas. It's not like it's not news.
Right.
But the thing is, it's just like this is true of the entire journalism industry. When I was growing up, they used to have reporters. All the TV networks and all the newspapers had people stationed in Olympia, and they would cover the legislature like crazy.
Yeah.
Well, over the years, people have lost interest in all the legislation, and so they've ripped up their bureaus. We don't have people in Olympia here at Cairo anymore, mm-hmm. and they don't do it at any of the TV stations. And it's like, okay, good. We're responding to our viewers or readers or listeners. And the problem with that just feels like, if I was a reporter, I'm not sure I'd see this as good news. They get a banner that they're given or whatever, a tote board that tells you when you've written how, you know, important it's been for our subscription drive, rather than, wow, that was wonderful journalism, good for you.
Right.
And that's part of the problem. Sometimes you end up winning Pulitzer Prizes for newspapers that go under because it doesn't satisfy the readership.
Well, I wanted to look up the latest I could find. Seattle Times 2016 Most Read Stories.
Ah, okay.
Number one, Ingrid Lynn Slade dismembered. Rent a nurse vanished on April, right? Okay. This is 2016. She dismembered.
Yeah.
Number two, so this gives you some idea. Oh, don't forget, people want deep stories. They want stories that really mean a lot about the environment.
Yeah.
Number two, I have got Sir Mix-a-Lot's old number. That's the second most read story. So the whole idea of, oh, people really care. Like I always said to Jacob, the Washington Post does the same thing. You look at it online, it'll do the top five read stories.
Yeah.
It's always like golden retriever plays in the snow with a cat. And you're like, really? Oh, the Washington Post. And that's what people want. Yeah. That's what they want to watch. And then you go all the way down the bottom, might have some, you know, whack piece on Trump. But most of the stuff at the top is like, I think my husband might actually be a woman. It's like, well, wait a minute. That's supposed to be in the National Enquirer.
Yeah.
But the Washington Post, it just goes to show you, people have that type of curiosity for those types
of
stories.
No matter what. But in defense of the Seattle Times and maybe the Washington Post, too, a subscription model is different from a most read model.
Okay.
And I think they would argue that, you put dismemberment in a headline, it's bound to get a clicks.
Mm-hmm.
But just if that might not be the reason. The reason I subscribe, if you subscribe to the Washington Post, might be for the political coverage. But it is true, on any given day, you're more apt to read a story about dismemberment than you are about the umpteenth story about the shutdown or something else.
Yeah.
Even though you wouldn't subscribe if it was only dismemberment stories. And so the Seattle Times, I think, could justify themselves by saying, no, if people are willing to put their money where their mouth is and say, this is not only the most read, but this is a story that I'm upping my subscription with, then, you know.
So do you have the newspaper, the actual paper delivered to your house?
Because
you feel sorry for their inefficiency?
Yes.
Do you continue to reward their inefficiency?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
It's loyalty because I want to do my, it's just like why I buy books at my local bookstore, even though I know I could get them for 30% cheaper on Amazon. I want to keep that infrastructure alive.
That probably costs them money to deliver that to your house.
Cost what?
I think that they probably start to lose money delivering paper to your home. I think they would rather you not be having paper.
Well, let's check this out. When they tell me that, I'll drop it in a second.
Okay. Let's see. El Chapo's trial. Now, don't forget, this guy's escaped from prison twice. He's the one that basically runs all drugs in and out of the United States. And he now the jury sits there. I think what's the makeup of it? Like, I forget the male to female ratio in that jury. Sitting there listening to the stories. I would say within the first 5 minutes, you would know that this guy's guilty. You just want to know, like, what horrible atrocities has he actually done to his fellow man? And the list goes on and on. And every time you think, well, that's pretty bad. That'll shock the conscience of the court. Then they bring up another one as well. So the New York Times lists the biggest surprises in the case.
And what's odd about it is they leave maybe the, I don't know what you say, the most awful one till the end. And they say, but this was not allowed in court.
Yeah.
But let's start with that.
Yes, that's that one. That's the best
that
one.
Is the dismemberment headline kind of part of this story. That he, on a regular basis, routinely raped young girls, preferring 13-year-olds whom he considered his vitamins.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, and that was just seen as so, it would so taint the jury, because that's not really what he's on. He's not being tried for those.
No.
That it would be, as a character testimonial, it would taint the evidence. But still, just to get a sense of the kind of character we're dealing with. So one of the things, so they got all these headlines. I don't know, John, we can
what are some of your
favorites?
Stick out as just a, well, if you were in the jury, it would just shock you.
Well, I don't know if this is as much shock as it is, I took delight in this. Drug traffickers love plastic surgery.
Uh-huh.
They talk about how many times these people that are in the drug world have their faces changed, and there are all these stories about guys who died under a surgeon's knife because they'd done it too many times, and they talked about El Chapo's Colombian cocaine supplier, a guy named Geppetto. He changed his jawbone. He's changed his cheekbones, his eyes, his mouth, his ears, and his nose. He tried to get his fingerprints removed. That caused a circulation problem, and he's described when he showed up on the stand, he was wearing gloves because of the failed effort of trying to get his fingerprints removed. This is a quote from the article. His reddened skin looked like a melted wax pulled over his scalp.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is voluntarily done to change his outlook. How about you? You got a favorite one?
I like that. I also liked when they listed, not on this story, but a week ago, they listed El Chapo's possessions that he had.
Oh, yeah.
And the gold guns.
Uh-huh,
an actual solid gold pistol,
yeah.
Right, that he used to assassinate people with. Then they'd take you through the entire process of how he escaped from prison and how many people were on the take and just how many people would do anything they possibly could to keep him going, because even though he's a horrible human being who deals in drugs and kills people because of it, still people have this gigantic sense of loyalty to him. Besides, it's basically forced loyalty. If you don't have it, they'll just have you killed.
You're dead, yes.
Right.
Another thing, what he really wanted to do was direct. They said that it was. It turns out he wanted to direct a movie, and that's why. Remember, Sean Penn got this famous review when he was still on The Lam. He got this interview with him, and it was because he thought that there was an actress that he was trying to get a role in a movie that he wanted to direct, and so he contacted Sean Penn. Well, it says that in court, just to give you a sense of how starstruck he is, in court, they say he seemed ecstatic to see actor Alejandro Eda, who plays him on Netflix Narcos Mexico. Hey, there's me! There's me! I just love that idea. I mean, he's facing life in prison and, you know, never getting out again, we trust, and yet he's jazzed about who's going to play me in the movies.
I guess if you don't pay the full boat tuition, why not just drop the prices since no one's paying? So Cornish College has reduced its tuition 20% to increase enrollment. Q13's got the story. It's not just happening at Cornish, but across the United States.
As students are borrowing more and more to pay for college, some institutions are looking for ways to make it more affordable. It's called Tuition Reset, and Cornish College of Arts in Seattle is one of the first private colleges in the Pacific Northwest to make a cut in its fees.
So making Cornish education available to students across the spectrum, so expanding the opportunity to middle-income families, as well as lowering the debt burden for students to be able to get a Cornish arts education.
Tymus Jones says that at least half of the nearly 600 students currently enrolled will benefit from the tuition cuts. He says Cornish has already received about 50 additional applications since the reduction, which is music to some students' ears.
I actually had a conversation with my mentor for musical theater earlier this year about making the outreach more widespread and helping to have a more diverse community at the school, and I think that'll really help it.
Cornish's president says an increase in enrollment will offset the tuition reductions, but some students we spoke to say enrollment and tuition aren't their only concerns.
Our scholarships also got lowered in this, so out-of-pocket cost is the same. So I think there's going to be a lot of conversations between students, enrollment, and financial aid about how to keep the students here.
Though making money stretch can be a challenge for some college students, Tymus Jones says students know the value of getting an education at schools like Cornish, and that's how it competes with other schools that cost less. He says the goal is to make it easier for students to learn now and thrive while owing less after graduation.
Plus, you have to include the other part of the equation, which is when you get out with a degree, you don't earn a whole lot. So I'm looking at Cornish overall value. It gets a C+. That's based on average net price, earnings potential, student and alumni reviews, and additional factors. 100% of the students say they're getting their money's worth. 48% graduate. Medium income 2 years after graduation, $21,000.
Yeah. That's the problem. I mean, there are a lot of liberal arts schools doing this. This is an art school. I mean, literally, performing arts, but an art school, not English and history major kinds of schools. And that's what they say. They don't. When you take out a big loan, if you're a doctor and you go into debt, you know that you're going to be able to recoup, the cost of your education. Mm-hmm. That's much tougher. And even then, it's tough when it's up in the hundred thousand dollars. In this particular case, it's even more striking. And one of the problems they mentioned, that if you are a really hard luck case, you can get financial aid.
Yeah.
The tricky thing is for that you know, lower middle income area or middle income where it's tough to go into that much debt. Mm-hmm. And so the option is, you know, not go to school or take out bigger and bigger loans.
So they're below the, they're a little above the average as far as debt is concerned. $7,466 a year. The national is $6,700. Mm. 3% loan default, where the national is 11%. I talked to a guy on Saturday at the Bellingham Rotary, and I was saying about, you know, he's got three kids in college. He's complaining about it. He says, well, my daughter got almost a full ride to the U. She pays, wow. We pay a little bit. He said, it's not the college that cost us. He goes, it's the expense of her living there. It's $2,500 a month. He goes, so she has a car, so I got the insurance, but he goes, the rent is so high.
Yeah.
And then the food. So he says, what happens is like the college price is this, but now everything else around it is the additional that you didn't even really, well, of course he thought about it.
Yeah.
But he says, that's the other sort of cost. So if you're a Cornish student,
yeah,
going to Cornish and what, living up there at Capitol Hill?
Well, you
or somewhere nearby?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about Cornish is I would guess that most people live spread. I mean, you could live in Shoreline and still go to Cornish. But still, the idea is that...
That would not be fun.
That would. Well, the thing is, I would guess most... My guess is most people would do that.
Wait, you want to be a college kid living in Shoreline? You want to be an art student living in Shoreline?
You would rather do that than live in a dorm, probably. I was going to say, see, at least at the University of Washington, the first year or two, you can live in dorms. Dorms are definitely a good deal and cheaper given the rates. I'm assuming that this daughter of his is living on her own,
she has an apartment nearby. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And so that's what's really expensive. If she, you know, shacked up with three or four other people, it would, you know, help kind of a lower cost. But yeah, a place like Cornish can't afford to have dorm rooms for pizza.
Let's see. We'll come back and talk about the thing known as the Holocaust paradox. So apparently life was so hard in those concentration camps that those that died were the weak. And those that survived were the extra strong.
Let's not put it that way. Yes.
Well, this is how they lay it out, and then it basically just sort of culled out those that couldn't take it.
Yeah. If you are gassed, you're not weak, John.
I understand that. I know that. I'm just talking about, no. If you die by the hands of the Nazis that take you into the showers, I'm saying the others that worked at the death camps that's really intriguing. Right. That's in the book. Search for Man's Meaning of Life.
Viktor Frankl. Yeah. Search for Man's Meaning. That.
We'll be back with that. Plus, also, to lighten things up, Tom and I will talk about dating. Because Rachel was supposed to talk about that, but she couldn't make it in because of the snow.
She lives right where I do.
Come on, Rachel Bell. We'll be right back. It's going to be painful.
Bad date.
All righty, here we go. The Online Trading Academy text line at 989-973. Or come on through the other doors as well, because we do love to hear from you. That's mynorthwest.com and also the Tom and Curly Facebook page. And you come in through the Tom and Curly Facebook page door, can try to move some of the dust and bunnies.
Cobwebs.
That's right. When you go through that door, you're going to get hit with a big spider web left over from our Halloween decorations from 2014. All right. By the way, this was supposed to be Rachel's segment. Shout out to her. Tom made it in.
That's right. Earlier than...
Now, where does she live?
She lives within a mile of me in Greenwood.
Mm-hmm. All right. Stays like this. Jacob, take note. Andrew, take note.
Has been taken.
Thank you. All right.
Okay.
So this is going to be you and I talking about.
That's okay. I mean, this is a story that we would talk about.
We run out of steam on. I'm going to go into debunking the myths of male sexuality. But apparently guys don't think about sex all the time. And guys are not in the mood for it all the time.
Okay.
So if we run out of steam on this, I got this. I've read the first two paragraphs. So
you're set for 3 days.
Here we go.
Okay.
Number one, 8 dates could save your marriage or prevent a bad one.
Nicole Broder does what a lot of us in Seattle who've covered journalism for a long time, when you do lifestyle features, the Gottmans are always great to talk about. The Gottmans, John and Julie, I think they're called.
The Gottman Institute.
The Gottman Institute. It's about how couples relate. They've been covered, you know, by just about every outlet, probably even 60 Minutes. And what they do is they figure out what works with couples and what doesn't. So they claim, in effect, that if you come in within like a span of 5 minutes, they'll be able to tell if this couple's going to make it or not make it by the way they interact with each other. All very, it's very talkable information, and it's all very fun for those of us, which is most of us, I assume, are in relationships or marriages or something. And now they have a new book, and so they're hawking this new book, and it's called 8 Dates. And the basis of this, again, that's based on Nicole Broder's column, is that in 2009, so about a decade ago, they put microphones, obviously with their permission, into the homes of 30 couples just to get a sense of how these couples interacted. And they said that what was most astonishing to them was that the couples, on average, talked to each other for a total of 35 minutes a week. That's how little conversation, you know, a couple would have.
Yeah.
So they say, and he said it was mostly about errands, you know, things to do. I mean, it's just, in effect, it's mostly the kind of, how do we get through the day or how do we get through the week? You know, make sure you got to pick up,
you know,
baby wipes or whatever. So they said that one of the things they started working on was what can you do to keep a marriage or a conversation, which they think is the key, and I do too, obviously. Conversation is key. How do you go about doing this? And they have this setup where they call it 8 dates, and they claim that, and this is, they did this where a third of the couples were, you know, unmarried, and a third, and 2/3 of the couples, or at least were new couples, and 2/3 were longtime couples, and they had them go through these exercises. And what they basically do is they end up forcing you to talk now about various topics, and they're very sort of understanding. But first off, you have to make the commitment to take the time to do this. So that's the first thing. Then you have to commit to listening to each other. You got to find the right words, explain how you're feeling, and then ask your partner these kinds of questions. Various established stuff. But what this book does is it goes through, okay, the topic of the day is like a password. And so they talk about, one, trust and commitment. Another topic, sex and intimacy, work and money, family, fun, growth and spirituality, and dreams, and they walk you through a bunch of questions you can ask each other, and they claim that at the end of that, you will have this much better sense. You have connected with the person that you supposedly love or are involved with, and that's a good thing. They're like conversation topics to walk you through how to save your marriage or make your marriage better or, you know, make a prospective marriage strong.
This fits in with the, 36 questions to ask to fall in love, that was done. And around Valentine's Day, they always put that up, the 36 questions. And then at the end, after you ask the 36 of each other, you talk about it, you stare into each other's eyes silently for 4 minutes, and then you're supposed to have fallen in love.
Yes, they say that. And the reason that it's so easy to fall in love is because it's so rare when you have a relationship with another human being that is that deep, that you go 36, you know, and you'd kind of dive deep. Yeah. And you end up knowing that person so well, there's something really attractive about somebody who you know that well. And so supposedly it puts you together. In a lot of ways, John, I'm Catholic, and I went through pre-Cana classes in order to get married in the church.
Yeah.
And so what we had to do was the same kind of thing where you just sit down with your partner and you talk. And everybody laughs. Oh, it's so ridiculous. This big institutional, you know, series of questions and all this. But I think, how is that a bad thing? You're spending 2 hours a week for 7 weeks talking about serious issues.
Yeah.
That's a good thing. And I think that's, in effect, that's what I think this book, 8 Dates, does and is probably a good for.
Let me tell you something I read, see what you think about this. They said the best marriages are not where you both are tending the same garden.
Ah, I see. Okay.
You have a separate garden. You have a garden, and she has a garden.
Yeah.
And in your garden, you grow what you want to grow, and she grows what she wants to grow, and the only time you come together is in celebration of the bounty, or you go over to her garden and help her, or she comes over to your garden. But the important thing is, if you really love the other individual, have an interesting garden.
Yeah.
Have choices. I mean, make choices and have hobbies, have interest, have something that really stimulates you and makes you a curious, interesting, intellectual person or someone that at least has something to talk about.
Yeah.
But if you come home on a Wednesday afternoon or a Wednesday evening and you binge watch Netflix for 5.5 hours with this other person, you're not tending your garden. You're not making yourself a more interesting person. By having only one garden, well, then you make compromises. Well, you're going to grow tomatoes because I'm going to grow peas over here. Well, your peas are going to take up my tomatoes. So now all of a sudden we have one garden. Two separate gardens coming together makes for a more interesting couple.
And or I think a third option might be that you have your garden, I have my garden, and then you have a shared garden.
Okay.
I mean, in a lot of ways, I think that's right. I think you can't. One of the dangers, they say, is that a lot of couples lose themselves into parenting because they identify themselves only as a parent, and right. they don't nurture anything outside of their parental role. And then when the parents move out, you have this empty nest crisis, right. and who am I sitting across from? That, I think, is a danger, and I think it's important that we all allow each other to flourish. The danger, although, if you have separate gardens, is you may become more interested in your garden than you are in sharing her garden, you know, the two of you. If you live completely separate lives, there's no point in, living together. In fact, I remember one of the points during our pre-Cana classes, they were saying that what you don't want to do is you don't want to just become roommates.
Yeah,
you get along, and yeah, you know, and we'll do this. You do the laundry, and I'll wash the dishes or cook or something. But the thing is, you want to keep it the intimacy alive, and so you don't want to just have this kind of, yeah, we get along well enough to live under the same roof if you're not having deep, meaningful conversation.
Well, people falls into role play. And once you get into role play, it's pretty much over as far as the intimacy is concerned.
How is that? What do you mean by role play?
That's what you fall into. That's what I do. And that's what you do. And then,
okay.
Right.
I hear tell that role play is a way to spice up your life, too.
That's
a different kind of role
play. That involves a French maid out there. Or a Girl Scout. You get all that on Amazon.
Yes.
Cheerleader outfit.
We're done. I think we're done. Sexy nurse, sexy cheerleader, sexy cop.
I'm about to arrest you.
How soon is
that's
Halloween?
That's a moving violation. I got a million. We'll be right back. Still coming down out there, Tom. Lines are down from here to Topeka. Better put another pot of coffee on, Grace. I hear Carl's driving the bus. What's that from?
I can't wait till Marilyn Monroe shows up.
That's William Inge's bus stop.
Yep.
It's the first play I was ever in at Ithaca College.
And you were the star?
I was. I was Bo Decker. I was so bad that the director called me aside 2 days before, 2 weeks before opening and said, I'm going to have to replace you with the understudy.
I've heard. And what did you do to get back into his good
graces?
I said,
well, what can I do to improve the scenes? And he goes, I'll give you a list. And it was long. And I don't know how, but I kept it. I kept the role, so that's good. They were going to replace me with the woman who played the lead in The Waltons, the mom in The Waltons, not the grandma, but the other lady, Michael Lerner, whatever her name was. Yeah, it was her son was supposed to replace me, waiting in the wings, waiting to stab me in the back.
I just don't understand, if that was your first role, why didn't they cast you in small parts first? And
I don't know.
Up to the lead?
I was the only straight guy there.
Straight guy, I got
you. I got to play a rodeo star, Tom. Come on now. All right, let's see. It's known as the Holocaust Paradox, and they did a study in JAMA, which is the Journal of American Medicine. And what they found when they looked at people born between the ages of 1911 and 1945, and they were trying to figure out if you went through the Holocaust and you spent time in a concentration camp, the assumption was it was so stressful on the body, you had lost so much weight and you were so exposed to so many horrible diseases, and it might have even broke your will to live, that you would die sooner.
Yes, and it turns out that was sort of a given. The writer of this particular article talks about when he was going to school, his teachers would tell him this kind of stuff, and it turns out just the opposite proved to be the case, that the average age of someone in a concentration camp that had survived a concentration camp, they lived to be 85 years old, whereas the general population at that same time and age, the average death day was at the age of 78.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, so what is it about that? And there are two kinds of theories. One is that, in effect, you inadvertently, and again, we were sort of playing a little loose with the effects. If you died in a concentration camp, you were most likely killed in a concentration camp. But if you weren't, the people that did die that weren't gassed or killed immediately, the weaker ones would have died off. Yes. Whereas if you were strong enough to survive a concentration camp experience, it might be a kind of weeding out the weaker, and it's a survival of the fittest or the strongest, and that might explain it. And the second thing is more psychological. That if you have the grim and determination to make it through, whatever kind of psychological makeup you have to make it through, you might have that kind of grim determination to make it through life and not, you know, and just sort of that kind of drive really, you know, pushes you. And, you know, it is interesting when I was reading this, I'm not Jewish in any way that I'm aware of. But my mother, who's 80, about to turn 88 this next week, she survived the Depression. Mm-hmm. And the way she talks about surviving the Depression, she was very poor. She was a very, this is before Social Security. This is before there was a aid and stuff. But she has a kind of grit and determination about her that I think really does contribute to how long she's managed to live. Mm-hmm. And so from that point of view, this is kind of the silver lining in a horrible cloud of concentration camps.
If you read Viktor Frankl's piece, his book, which he wrote in 7 days, and he wanted it, by the way, he wanted to remain anonymous.
Is that right?
He said to his publisher, I don't want anybody to know it was me. I don't want to make it about me. I want to make it just about the experience. They said, you have to put your name on it. So he agreed to that, and he wrote it. And he talked about, you knew when someone had given up, you could smell that they had smoked their cigarettes, because people would have cigarettes.
And hoard them.
And hoard them and hold them and use them for cash. He says, when you'd see the guy laying in the cot smoking a cigarette, you knew he'd be dead within the next 24 hours.
Wow.
All right.
Giving up.